welcome to Eye to the Sky, the UFO Synopsis. Now here's your host, DeAndrew.
And welcome to Eye to the Sky, the UFO Synopsis, here in UFO Paranormal Radio Network, also broadcast live on UPRN 105.5 New Orleans. I'm your host, DeAndrew, and tonight my guest is Peter Robbins. Peter Robbins has been involved in UFO studies for more than 30 years as a researcher, investigator, writer, lecturer, archivist, author. He is co-author of the British bestseller Left at Eastgate, a first-hand account of the Rendlesham Forest UFO incident, its cover-up and investigation. In addition, Mr. Robbins has lectured extensively in the States and abroad. And for several years now, Peter has been working with the City of New Orleans, the City of Roswell, New Mexico, to help organize the annual Roswell UFO Festival. I personally feel that his involvement in this has helped to assure that each year's festival is lively, entertaining, and most importantly, informative for those who attend. Peter Robbins has been a guest on Eye to the Sky many times, and he is always one of my favorite researchers to have on the program as my guest. It is a great pleasure for me to be able to welcome him back as my guest again this evening. And welcome back, Peter.
Hi, Dee, and thank you for that wonderful introduction. As usual, I will put a crisp $10 bill into an envelope and get it off to you and David.
Oh, well, that will go into the pay for the website account. How's that? Oh, gosh, Peter, since we mentioned in the intro that your involvement with the city of Roswell and the yearly festival there, why don't we start off with that?
That sounds great. This will be my third year working with the city in a number of capacities, including media liaison, coordinator of the UFO symposium, advisor on UFO-related tourism, and person on the ground to help manage all this stuff over the extraordinary 4 days we have planned, which we expect to attract at least 15,000 people.
That's a lot of people.
It is a lot of people, and the hotels and beds and breakfasts and motels and car rentals and restaurants and really all of the businesses, even the most indirectly related, are delighted that we have, we being the city of Roswell, are putting such an investment into this. Like many American cities, it has a number of special events and festivals around the year, but this will almost certainly be the very best business week for their business community, which I think is wonderful. Like most American municipalities right now, their back is to the wall, like all of our cities and towns and villages financially. But by a quirk of fate, they own a brand. I don't know how else to say it. It's kind of dispassionate and businesslike, but all over the world, people know this name. Some snigger or laugh at it or think of the old WB series of, you know, modelly-looking teens who just happen to be extraterrestrials. Others have studied some of the tremendous contributions to the scholarship of the actual events of 1947 and realize that arguably the best-known, most paradigm-shifting event of humanity's last few thousand years happened on the plains of St. Augustine and outside of the city limits of this southwestern city. So we're going for, like you said, something that is entertaining, extremely family and kid-friendly. Smack in the middle of which will be a very distinguished and I think fascinating two-day symposium on the study. You know the lineup. We've got some wonderful presenters from some of the best known to some of the best qualified. I'm also very proud to say that the city has even agreed to pick up the tab on the symposium, so anybody that wants to come, you will be the guests of the city of Roswell free of charge. We're also having a film festival, which is scheduled for different venues around town. And the theme of it is aliens in film, but specifically films that have been made in New Mexico. And it's quite a collection of them. I'm not sure if I have it here on my computer, but there'll also be a wide variety of musical and other performances. The city, working with Marvel Comics, has spent some serious money bringing out a number of actors in, you know, multi-thousand-dollar costumes licensed from Marvel to do reading workshops for kids. It's just really going to be an extraordinary 4 days, and I'd say it's going to be as sociologically interesting as it will be for anybody that's serious about the subject. But if you are someone who thinks that this is all lighthearted nonsense and folks like us are a little bit loose in the screws, come prepared to take in some serious presentations. And if you are a scholar devoted to this subject or somebody that just takes it seriously, come prepared to have a good time.
Oh, well, if you stop and think about it, if you've got at least 15,000 people showing up for this event, that's a lot of people who are interested in the UFO subject.
It is. Of course, there's no clear demographic. People will come for all the reasons we can imagine, and I'm sure some that we can't. It will be a rather unusual 4th of July, and a very old-fashioned 4th of July at the same time. There's a wonderful parade, a fireworks exhibit that you can compare to any that you've seen that'll run at least 20 minutes, a free concert afterwards, and every kind of... our vendor hall is basically packed with authors, filmmakers, documentary folks, people selling every kind of book and UFO-related paraphernalia imaginable. Roswell also has a great variety of restaurants, bars, a whole bunch of different ethnic food vendors. It's been a real privilege and a real education these past couple of years working with the team on the ground there. As you know, I'm here in New York State, and I'll be going out next week and be there for about 2 weeks. And I'm hired by the city. All but one or two of the folks that I work with are volunteers, and most of them work harder than I do. And their ability to get the job done is an inspiration to me and makes me realize what we're capable of when we're involved in something that we really believe in.
Oh, well, gosh, last year when David and I went, oh, wow, did we have a great time.
And I'm so sorry you won't be able to be there this year.
Unfortunately.
Well, next year, after you win that lottery.
Oh, hey, we've got our lottery
tickets
for today.
Sending you $10 bills.
I mean, you know, the restaurant quality is way up there.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, the hotels and motels, you know, if you guys are going to be there, you know, start booking your rooms now.
They're
going to go quick.
It's true. I think that, you know, somewhere between 85-90% right now as we head into the final 2 weeks before the events are pretty much locked in. Also, if you're coming in from out of town and you prefer, and it's certainly an option and financially easier and weather friendly, there's lots of very well-equipped campgrounds in the area. So, you know, a lot of mobile homers who more and more now, you know, RV folks who travel around in the summer because it just makes more sense than, you know, trying to take a vacation and fly to another country right now. It's amazing how many people from all over the states attend this, how varied their backgrounds are. Again, the reasons that they're there, for some of them, it's just overt and abject curiosity, and why not? A UFO festival? What's that going to be like, especially over the 4th of July? the community itself is very supportive, and yet, like every community in the world, I think if you interviewed people down the line, you'd find for every person that feels, boy, this is amazing that this extraordinary event occurred in our backyard and it's something we should be very proud of, there are folks that are vaguely embarrassed. And then, and I say this with all respect, there are serving and retired members of the military who live in Roswell who kind of lead the very serious thought of, why do we have to share the most sacred American holiday with this wild kind of thing? Well, the reason for that, of course, is just a coincidence in history. We don't know exactly when this machine or machines of undetermined origin came down, but the debris field was found by ranch foreman Mac Brazel the first or the second day of July. It could have been a day, a week before. But we're stuck with the fact that we have this historic imperative, and that is why it happens at this time of year.
This is true. The best estimate is around the anywhere between the 2nd and the 4th of July. Mm-hmm. Nobody knows for sure the exact, well, the general, let me put it this way, the general public.
Yeah, we sure
know.
Don't. But we have a very close window there, that's for sure.
Yeah. I was looking at the presenters list, and there's some pretty interesting topics coming up.
Yes, there are. This is the first year that I've been the actual coordinator. I've been a speaker. Once again, I'll serve as MC this year and oversee the panel discussion at the end. I'll even be giving a paper this year for the first time in my life, not one that I've written. I'm going to be giving a paper for a presenter who is not able to attend. But we decided early on that rather than take the path, not a bad path at all, that we've taken the past few years, that this would be a absolutely focused Roswell-centric conference. And so each speaker will be speaking from their specialty area of knowledge or a focus that they've chosen to explore on an aspect of the Roswell crash, its impact on, you know, any number of things, or in one case, the Socorro, New Mexico crash, which is certainly related in a number of respects. But it actually makes sense to take a few minutes and go through some of the presenters here. First up will be Guy Malone, who is a local researcher, and he will be taking, I guess I'd have to say, the devil's advocate position, that whatever happened there was not what many of us feel. And some years ago, my dear friend and colleague Nick Redfern had the courage to put forward a thesis that Roswell was not the crash of a machine from places unknown, but indeed a sequence of classified, very terrestrial operations that, due to a certain amount of misunderstanding, misinterpretation, were perceived as extraterrestrial or, you know, whatever you want to call it, in nature. So Guy will be picking it up to start with, that it wasn't a spacecraft that was being covered up, but that the spacecraft was used to cover up what had actually occurred there, and I won't be a spoiler and go into that. Dennis Balthaser, a name that some of your listeners may know, because Dennis is one of the most prolific columnists and commentators that we have on the subject of UFOs in general and Roswell in specific. He has a background as a civil engineer and has lived in Roswell for many years. And he's going to be talking about the incident as it was perceived back then in 1947 compared to how we have come to see it. Following that is Alejandro Rojas, another good friend and fine colleague. Alejandro works for the growing and very intriguing UFO information-based multimedia company Open Minds. And he's going to be talking on Roswell's effect on culture and the media. And he's uniquely qualified to do so. Up until last year, when he took this position with this Phoenix-based media company, he was director of, I guess, how can I say, a media liaison for MUFON with all broadcast and print media, and his paper should be absolutely fascinating. Now, I'm actually going in order here. Following him is going to be a very special event. It's going to be the second annual Roswell Hall of Fame induction ceremony, and even as we speak, selected folks who are involved in the festival, and in fact, to some degree, related to individuals that were involved in the original incident, are voting on people who will be inducted in three different categories. Last year, we decided to begin the Hall of Fame with the induction of one single person, and I think that was a very wise and moving idea, and that person was Jesse Marcel Sr. And Mayor Sam Legrone made that presentation to his son, Jesse Marcel Jr., who is now just leaving the United States Air Force in his 70s, having completed his service in Iraq as a flight surgeon. You've met Jesse. He is one in a million. He's a remarkable guy.
Yes, and I've had him on my program,
yeah,
and it was
just
interesting.
The best. And he, of course, was about 12 years old during the crash and enters into the direct story, as many of you listeners know, by being woken up in the middle of the night by his dad and asked to come down to the kitchen. And there was a box of debris, including the famous little I-beam with the hieroglyphs on it. And so even as a youngster, this was not some vague, you know, mystical or legendary event. He was involved. And this year we're honored to have Jesse making the presentations, one in the same category as his dad, essentially people who were involved and suffered, tried to get word out, made a point of making their thoughts and memories known to posterity. The second is people who have contributed to our knowledge in their writing and lectures and scholarship and research. And the third would include people in the media, in the media, whether it be documentary filmmakers, film directors, screenwriters, people who have brought us the story of Roswell, or been able to add to our knowledge indirectly as well as entertaining us at the same time. This is going to be followed by a talk I'm really looking forward to by a speaker I've only heard once, but I think he's sensational. His name is Ken Storch, and Ken has been a law enforcement officer for over 30 years. He became interested in UFOs back in the 30s when he was working in the Air Force with the Strategic Air Command. He's no nonsense, and he will be discussing Roswell from the point of view of having investigated, as law enforcement personnel are trained to investigate criminal activity. Again, I have been in touch with Ken this week, and I'm not going to give away any of his stuff, but it will not just be informative, but this man is a first-class presenter. In fact, all the people working this year, it's an extraordinary lineup. We then go to another local Roswell scholar, and a guy in his own right who's really without peer. Donald Burleson is the author of, I think, over 20 books. He's a PhD. He's MUFON New Mexico State Section Director. And he's going to be talking about the Socorro UFO incident in 1964, scientific considerations and drawing parallels to Roswell. And, of course, Socorro is a well-known and well-documented case as well. From this point, the next day, we have a presenter who I think you've had on your show, and that is Mr. James Clarkson.
Oh, yes.
And James has been polishing and working on the presentation that blew many of our minds last year on June Crane, the really remarkable woman who was employed by the Wright-Patterson Air Force Base for many years, who was never allowed to speak about her knowledge of Roswell and related events during her lifetime, and over the course of the friendship that they developed, left all of her papers and documents and journals, etc., to James, who spent several years putting together a really, really powerful presentation, not just in the information, but emotionally, it really knocked a lot of us out. And he is a very, how can I say, very self-effacing individual, extremely modest. He's also got a law enforcement background, worked as a detective in Washington State for many years, and probably even more challenging, a detective for Washington State Child Services, which has got to be extraordinarily rough work in many respects. Following this, I'm going to be speaking, but I'm going to be presenting a paper for my friend Dean Merchant. Not a well-known name, but Dean has kind of mined a vein of information that none of the rest of us have really looked into, and many of the rest of us, even folks, and I'll put myself in that category, who are supposed to be knowledgeable about this subject, were frankly even aware of. It is the 509th Bomb Wing, which of course was stationed at Roswell Army Airfield at the time, and many of us feel a greater point of attraction to why the events happened in that area. But the atomic bomb wing's connection to the crash at Corunna, Roswell, and the incident at Exeter in New Hampshire. Most folks don't know that when the 509th was rotated out of Roswell in 1959, 12 years after the events of 47, of course, they were restationed at Pease Air Force Base in New Hampshire. And guess what followed? A tremendous amount of documented UFO activity and connections that, if I were not reviewing his paper and his research right now, and coincidences, if you want to call them that, that I would have thought were close to fictional. But he has done his homework for years, and due to health considerations, Dean will not be able to present the paper himself, so I'm going over it right now and making notes and bouncing it back to him, and he's finalizing his PowerPoint now, but this is a really new experience for me, and I am really privileged to present it. In fact, I'm even going to take a moment here and read you his abstract. This is the Roswell story, part two. When the 509th arrived on the New Hampshire seacoast in 1958 and stayed for three decades, after the 509th arrived, the UFOs followed them to the atomic triangle, in quotes. Pease Air Force Base, the nuclear naval shipyard, the first nuclear sub Swordfish was launched from there in the late 50s, the same week as the 509th arrived, and the controversial Seabrook nuclear power plant, all within 20 miles of each other. From that point in time, a plethora of UFO phenomena blossomed. A solid case will be presented that materials recovered at Corunna were developed, tested, and perfected by the 509th at Pease Air Force Base in New Hampshire, resulting in the B-2 Stealth, Spirit Bomber, and other craft using anti-gravity technology. Recall the incident craft. The presentation will include fresh, well-researched new material, and all I can tell you is that I am just enwrapped by this right now, and still going through the presentation. Following Dean's talk are two of my favorite people, and in fact, the best and the best known brother-sister UFO research team in ufology, Chuck Zukowski and Debbie Ziegelmeyer. They are a piece of work. They're as funny and smart as they are informed and dedicated. unlike almost any of us, they've done a lot of actual field investigation out at the crash sites over the years. Also very involved in educating other ufologists and training MUFON members. And they founded the underwater UFO
Yes, with Debbie.
Yeah, amazing people. From there, we're going to Karen Dolan, not as well known as Rich Dolan, her husband, but Karen is a force worthy of respect in this work, who pioneered an area of study that also I was amazed that nobody had taken on earlier, which is hugely important, the impact of this subject on young people, whether it be, the kind of implied messages for youngsters, really young kids, who are sold breakfast food with a cheerful alien cartoon, or see them in their picture books, or, you know, walk in as mom and dad are watching a serious documentary on abductions or what have you. But her talk is how the Roswell incident took ufology to a new level. She will be followed by Rich Dolan's presentation, Roswell in Fact and History. And Rich is taking a two-track approach to Roswell in this. He's going to first present the events as we have come to understand them, then describe in detail the story of how this story rose to singular prominence after 30 years of being buried, as well as the ensuing debates and arguments about ufology's most important case which have followed. So I think it's going to be a sensational symposium, and it will run again for two full days. And one thing that has just happened in the last really 72 hours, I feel like I live there, the city of Roswell's film festival, which is a pretty good lineup to start with, has scored a real world-class coup. On Thursday or Friday, I got a call from my friend Larry Landsman. Larry is the former director of special projects for the Sci-Fi Channel, and we worked together on a number of things when I worked for them as a freelancer. In fact, I'm very proud that he championed my idea to make a feature documentary for American television on the Rendlesham Forest UFO incident, and it was so well received that Sci-Fi funded two more equally compelling documentaries, all three of them, I'm sure, with serious six-figure budgets, an hour and a half in length, and the very establishment frontman, oh, gosh, why am I blanking out on him? He's such a fixture on American television. I'll think of it. The guy who acted as the host on the shows, a face known to many Americans. I'll get back to it. But since Sci-Fi changed hands, it was purchased by NBC about 2 years ago, they have not funded a new independent documentary on UFOs until now. And on July 11th, all of your listeners should tune in Sci-Fi to see their new documentary, which, I mean, I haven't seen it. I've just heard about it. But I understand it will present some shocking new information of an artifact that has been analyzed in the extreme relative to Roswell. And the film festival will... Well, the film festival, in the moment, we will break during the actual symposium to show this documentary for the first time outside of the offices of the filmmakers or of the headquarters of NBC at 30 Rockefeller Center. And we're all very excited about that. And if you go online to the city's festival and symposium website, which is UFOFestivalRoswell.com, you can read that press release. So, yeah, that's just, you know, again, my baby and the subject that is, I think, the most serious aspect of this amazing series of events that they're going to be having. But that's the wrap-up of it. And it's Brian Gumbel, who was the MC, the commentator on all three of those major documentaries.
Ah, yes, he did Kecksburg, Rendlesham, and Roswell.
That's right. Quite a triad.
Believe it or not, I recorded every one of
them.
Half of them on tape.
Oh,
yes, my.
I remember that.
You know, with Clarkson, with his involvement with June Crane, I think that I got to give this lady a lot of credit for her courage. When she finally told him, you know, yes, I'll talk to you about this, she told him, and I'm quoting here from the website because I couldn't for the life of me remember it word for word, but what she said was, and I quote, "I'm 72 years old. I've outlived two husbands, and my cancer is in remission. What are they going to do? Shoot me or put me in prison? I can do either one."
Oh, what a tough broad she must have been.
You know,
what a decent, good-hearted woman, my gosh.
And I got to give the woman credit because, you know, she just got fed up with all the BS that the government was trying to say was the origins of the crash of Corona or St. St. Augustine, whatever you want to call it. You know, she just got fed up with the BS and says, okay, that's it. I can't keep my mouth shut any longer.
Yes. I've never heard a story quite like this. Again, we've all heard accounts of people who make certain allegations, and you'll have to take my word for this because I can't prove it because. Many of them may be factual. Many of them may not. But they have nothing to back it up. And June was not stupid. She had signed a national security oath statement, which is reproduced in the lecture, of course. And she would have been arrested and probably spent a good part of, if not the rest of her life, in the federal penitentiary at Leavenworth for revealing even some of what she knew. And in fact, I've got some great news for you and any of your listeners who are interested. I think only about 2 months ago, I got a great little surprise in the mail. It was a padded envelope from James, and in it was a book, and the book is titled Tell My Story, June Crane, the Air Force, and UFOs. And it is essentially the lecture expanded on. It is very down to earth. It is very moving, and it is so well documented. And you can get it by going to Jim's website, which is www.clarksonufo.com. It's probably available at Amazon or Barnes & Noble. I know it's published under the banner of Black Triangle Press. Nice, right? They're in Olympia, Washington, but I'm sure if you order it from Jim's website, you know, you can receive a signed or inscribed copy. And I read it like in a day and a half. It was one of those books that was very difficult to put down, even though I knew the story. I hope that at some time it is picked up by a major publisher, or that somebody smart approaches James and makes a deal to make a film of this courageous, heroic American woman's life. You wouldn't have to do much to change things around to make it still sound like absolute fiction, but it is all real. It really happened. And stories like this, I think, are particularly important in ufology, like Jesse Marcel's senior story in Paul David's very, very well-documented and moving film, Roswell, which starred Kyle MacLachlan and Martin Sheen, and Dwight Yoakam, doing a very serviceable job, better known, of course, as a country western singer, but he played Mac Brazel, and he did it brilliantly. And MacLachlan, you know, if it wasn't considered an outsider film, he should have been up for an Academy Award or something. His work spanning 30 years, and poor Jesse Sr., I mean, the way he was treated and humiliated and be made to recant the story that he was authorized to release and the impact on the next 30-plus years of his life. It's infuriating, it's fascinating, and it's part of American history that we don't learn about in schools. And June Crane's story, for me, joins hers. And Jim has done us a true public service by getting this out in book form.
Oh, now I got to get my hands on it.
I thought that might be the case. But you know what? What I would tell you is to give him a call or send him an email and invite him back on the show. And,
definitely.
You know, if you play your cards right, who knows? You might just, I'm not going to say it, but put him on the spot. But you know what I'm talking about.
Yeah, I do. most of the time I'll go out and buy the book.
Yeah, I do.
You know, because
it supports the people that do it, don't work.
Well, a lot of times, like, for example, if you buy an author's book through Barnes & Noble, I'm just using this as an example, say the book is like a $20 book, the author gets only like $4 or $5.
Yeah. Oh, yeah, you're talking about me right there. In fact, not even. And this is not unusual. Left at Eastgate sells for, I think, $23.95 if you buy it from Barnes & Noble or Amazon.com. And Larry and I, my co-author Larry Warren, we end up with about $1.25 each for every book sold like that. And unfortunately, that's not uncommon, but hey, what do you want for 9 years' work?
A lot more than a buck and a quarter.
And again, I think, I don't know whether Black Triangle Press is, that James established that, I should find out from him, or whether it is a local press in Olympia, Washington, but I sure hope he's got a much better deal than we did. Again, it is a very highly readable book, and it is one I would put in that category of books that are terrific to lend to your skeptical, doubting, debunking friends. This grounds it in a very well-documented area of American history, and the individual herself is not only credible, she is worthy of tremendous respect, very honorable, and never profited by a penny in her lifetime, like all the old-timers worth their salt who took their national security oaths seriously but felt that they had to go on record either before they died or after the fact. And I think I would feel the same way if it had been me.
I agree wholeheartedly. I'm going to kind of switch gears here for a moment. Let's see, tomorrow, the next live and unrehearsed Rendlesham Roundtable will be broadcast on Sunday, June 20th, radio special, the second in a series leading up to the incident's 30th anniversary this coming December. Let's see, there will be, oh gosh, take my glasses off so I can see this a little better. Okay, this will be broadcast live from 7 to 10 p.m. Eastern, 4 to 7 Pacific, on CBS New Sky Radio. People can listen live on CBS Radio High Definition channels, and this is in Boston, Detroit, and Seattle. Or you can listen online at www.newskyradio.com. And on terra-x.com.
Yeah. You're right, Dee. This is going to be a bit of broadcasting history we're going to have tomorrow night. As you know, and some folks in your audience as well, in April, we had our first of what we'll call a Rendlesham Roundtable. And this was the brainchild of several radio hosts leading the... The initiative was Paul Eno, who has had a show for many years on the paranormal in Rhode Island. And Paul had approached me and some other people, but his show is called Behind the Paranormal, and he does it with his son, Ben. And they approached, I think also a not also, but a brother combination of radio hosts whose show is CAPS Paranormal. And what they did is pretty unprecedented in radio. They essentially cleared it with their networks to push their 1 hour and 2 hour time slots together and create a live, unrehearsed, open discussion about the events of December 1980. But it is, well, it was the very first time in April that Larry Warren, certainly one of the best known and the first witness to come forward, and the whistleblower without whom we would even know about this story, co-author of Left at East Gate, and the former deputy base commander Charles I. Halt. We also had two call-ins from other legitimate, credible witnesses, and myself and Bill Burns of UFO Magazine, UFO Hunters, were on as people not involved in the incident, and I thought it was handled very, very well. There's not been a copacetic relationship between these two highly involved witnesses, and it was very impressive. The show tomorrow night, in a way, will be more historic because it will be the very first time ever that Larry and Jim Peniston and John Burroughs, both of whom John and Jim were involved up to their eyeballs on the first night, and John again on the second night, the three of them will be together for the very first time ever in any open forum, in person or on broadcast. On the sidelines will be our amazing hosts, and myself, Nick Pope, and again Bill Burns will be in there for commentary and clarification or whatever. They will be taking calls. They will be reading emails. We have worked out a series of protocols. Obviously, we have to observe FCC regulations, but we do not know what's going to happen. And again, there is not full agreement among these guys. Not that that's surprising. You know, interview 12 people who have observed an auto accident, and you'll get 12 different accounts, and talk about amplifying the shock. But I'm very excited about this, and a heads up is that Paul Eno, the first host, he has a time slot, I believe it's with CBS, and it's the last Sunday of every month for 2 hours. And if all goes as planned, beginning the last Sunday of July, we will have a monthly Rendlesham Roundtable, adding witnesses, adding scholars and knowledgeable researchers, and keep it going until at least late December of this year, and it will basically superimpose itself on the December 30th anniversary. I will be back in England at that time, out in the woods somewhere, thinking my thoughts, and hopefully not dodging too much snow. But this is really a very unique event in the history of ufology and live radio. So, again, you can listen to this live at www.newsradio.com or at para-x.com. And you can also go to the Behind the Paranormal with Paul and Ben Eno and CAPS Paranormal websites for additional information. But, yeah, this is going to rock.
I'm looking forward to it myself. I might wait till Monday, but
sure. Well, it'll be archived, of course.
And then that way I can cut out all the commercial breaks.
Yeah, smart.
I'm not working right now, so I've got a lot of time on my hands.
Enjoy the ride while it goes. Absolutely. This is big, and I'm really honored to be involved in it, and I have an idea of some of the people who were involved in this, who will be calling in and essentially become guests on the show from their homes.
you must have been reading my mind, because I was going to ask if you thought whether or not there'd be some people who were involved with this incident that will be listening and say, hey, I got to call in.
Well, count on it, Dee. I'm sure there'll be some listening who will not be interested in calling in, but the ones that I think may have been fully vetted, and they are the real deal. Nobody will be calling in and making believe they were involved, because they will be nailed immediately by the men who were there. So that ain't going to happen. And all of these people bring a different part of the puzzle to the story, and all of them have genuinely suffered because of what they have had to be carrying around. John Burroughs, I guess, in the past year or so has received more attention than either Larry or Jim, because Linda Howe has been working diligently with him, and they have done a number of very compelling presentations together. And John, I think, has showed an awful lot of courage by allowing us a window into the trauma that continues in his life via video footage of him in regression with his therapist. And there is something, I will characterize it as terrifying him, that he does not want to lift the curtain on. And, you know, people don't. This is not something that anybody is faking. The trauma is real. And I think he's got tremendous courage to be following in Larry's footsteps here, and having the guts to bring this story to another level. Jim also has been going through some very real stuff over the decades. And, you know, sunlight can help. It won't make everything nice and good, but the courage to come forward and share what they have experienced, their reflections, their thoughts, their knowledge, their fears, makes for tremendous additions to our knowledge, and again makes us remember how human this subject is. It goes beyond claims and cliches and allegations. These are real people who have been through extraordinary things that none of them asked to be put through, and they're all American heroes and deserve our attention and respect.
Well, you know, with Peniston, I tell you, the guy's got a little more guts than I've got.
Yeah.
To walk up
and
walk around this thing, reach out and touch it
without
knowing whether it was, you know, showing, you know, whether it was radioactive or not. You know, I mean,
his drawings and his notes are absolutely fascinating, and for anybody that has seen any of his story and a number of television treatments, I think one of the best was the sci-fi documentary that Larry and I worked on, UFO Invasion at Rendlesham. It's so interesting to me, the stuff that you observe between the lines. Form is one thing, content another, but as you see pages from Jim's notebook that night, you see, as he continues to write, his handwriting begins to literally break up. The stress is so real that you can see it right there. And as for touching the craft, the first thing I thought of when he started to go public with this was on the night of Larry's involvement, he and Sergeant Adrian Bastinza were ordered by the Master Sergeant on location to walk up to the craft, came within about 5 feet of it, and then backed off. But they were only 20 feet or so away to start with, so it wasn't like they were, you know, 100 yards away. And you're in a military situation. They were ordered, but Jim did it of his own initiative. Charles Halt, who for me continues to be certainly one of the most enigmatic figures, he is a genuine witness. He has suffered because of it. His career did not prosper as a result in the Air Force. I think that's fair to say. It caused him a fair amount of grief, and yet he has still run a certain amount of interference. But he seems to be more and more willing to discuss things that I can only allegorically salute him for. He has been through the mill on this as well, and he and Jim appeared on that documentary that Sci-Fi did and did a very compelling presentation of their own.
Oh, I agree. We've got a short question here in our virtual auditorium.
Yeah.
This is from Loonster, and he's asking, where is that tape recorder? From what I understand, you could probably verify this for me. Charles Culp still has the tape recorder and the original tape.
Mm-hmm. Yes, I am sure that's the case. It was not a military issue recorder. It was a microcassette recorder that were fairly new in 1980. I had one in the early 80s, but not quite then. He went out there, as anybody that's followed the story knows, as a skeptic. He had been at a party. His adjutant or assistant, I forget the term, had come up to him and said, "They're back." And his basic idea communicated to Larry and I when we met together in Virginia years ago was, "Yeah, right." And he went out there to disprove it with a team. But I will tell you something that most folks aren't aware of, the 15 or 16 minutes, whatever they are, that are on the public record, is not the recording. That Mr. Hult told us that he recorded several hours, and I can only imagine that he still has that. I don't know of anyone that has heard it except for him. Whatever initiative or incentive it will take for that to be made public, I do not know, but I hope at some point in the future he does allow us to hear more of it. So, yes, I'm sure he has the original tapes, and no reason that he doesn't still have the recorder. It was his to start with.
Exactly. And on that, we need to go to a break.
Mm-hmm.
So we'll be back here in 8 to 9 minutes with Peter Robbins here on Eye to the Sky, the UFO Synopsis on the UFO Paranormal Radio Network.
Welcome to Eye to the Sky, the UFO Synopsis. Now here's your host, DeAndrew.
This Wednesday evening, July 21st, and Joe and David will be discussing an abduction research proposal that David has put forth in a recent article he has written. If the research project they are going to discuss could ever come to fruition, then it has the potential to generate new and never before recorded information about the abduction phenomenon. I know my guest Peter Robbins has read David's article, and he gave it very high marks. Since this week's episode of UFO Undercover directly addresses other abductees and abduction research, host Joe Montaldo encourages other experiencers to tune in and voice their thoughts and opinions on this week's topic. And also, 2 hours after this program is done, I will be on In Focus Paranormal with Nick Ressler on Blog Talk Radio. And I'm looking forward to that tonight. And Peter, we've been also discussing Dean Merchant's material that you will be presenting at Roswell this year.
Yes.
And could we go through a little bit of it, you know, just a kind of little teaser?
I'm in the quirky position, literally, of taking a break right now to do your show to review the paper for the first time. I'm only literally about 5 pages into a more than 20-page paper. Dean has kindly given me permission to work the paper a bit, because there is, of course, a marked difference between a paper that is written to be read and one that is written to be read out loud. So I'm making little suggested changes here and there. But why not give you a preview of it? And this is... Your audience is the first ever to hear what I'm about to say. The title we have here is The Connection Between the 509th Bomb Wing, the Crash at Corona, the Alien Abduction of Barney and Betty Hill, and the Incident at Exeter. The 509th Bomb Wing was the most powerful and elite, ferocious and effective military force ever formulated. From 1945, when the group dropped the atomic bombs, which ended World War II after the loss of 50 million lives, until 2001, when they led the kick-down-the-door airstrike in Afghanistan, and 2003, when B-2 stealth bombers led the coalition shock-and-awe campaign against Saddam Hussein's regime, the reputation of the 509th has remained unparalleled in the annals of warfare. Its extraordinary Cold War capabilities to precipitate an event which could completely annihilate the human race deserved to be regarded with the same respect accorded to a force that could tear a hole in the fabric of our perceived reality. Perhaps it is no wonder that for much of its history, the 509th bomb wing has been entwined with the most important, dramatic, and prolific incidents of UFO phenomena, beginning with the crash outside of Corona, New Mexico in 1947, to Betty and Barney Hill's UFO experience and abduction in 1961, to the incidents at Exeter, New Hampshire in 1965. The bomb wing's activities would capture the attention of any intelligent force in the universe capable of observing these astonishing technological developments. Whether these advances were accomplished with billions of dollars of discreet Pentagon black budget funding, or through reverse technology derived from a recovered ET craft, it is probably beyond the reach of most of us living today to wrap our minds around the significance of these technological achievements and their future impact on the world. But with each step along the way, it seemed the 509th has been participatory and entrusted with aspects surrounding one of the great mysteries of our time. Is there other intelligent life in the universe? And has a concrete contact been made with extraterrestrial beings? Questions surrounding UFO phenomena date back to some of the earliest recorded commingling of humankind and artistic expression. From cave art or petroglyphs pecked onto stone to astonishing art objects such as a delta-winged shaped golden Mayan object or little cosmonaut-like statuettes, we are compelled to ponder illusions in our consciousness to unidentified flying craft and imagined alien life forms. Emblazoned upon coins, stamped with wood blocks, upon parchment, or etched upon the Peruvian landscape in the form of the Nazca lines, history tugs at our minds to question what lies beyond in deep space, beginning just an hour's drive straight from the Earth's thinly veneered surface just outside of our atmosphere. The atomic UFO era was ushered in by the 509th in 1944 at Wendover Field, Utah, with the activation of the 509th Composite Group, whose primary purpose was the delivery of atomic bombs on Hiroshima and Nagasaki. During the course of the war, so-called Foo Fighters were observed in both the European and Pacific theaters. Then in 1946, so-called Ghost Rockets were observed in the air over Scandinavia. Unidentified bright lights were also seen in the sky over Japan. These unexplained aerial objects were prophetic of things to come. In October 1945, the 509th returned to U.S. soil, landing at Walker Air Force Base, New Mexico, where the force was diminished to about 30 officers and enlisted men. In August 1946, as part of Operation Crossroads, a B-29 was renamed a B-29 from the renamed 509th Bombardment Group released an atomic bomb on a fleet of unserviceable vessels tethered offshore of the then pristine Bikini Atoll, a one-time paradise which remains uninhabitable to this day. Crossroads was an apt term, since at this juncture the 509th was to become the crown jewel of the newly formulated Strategic Air Command and the first line of defense against the bristling communist Soviet Union and the Red Scare, which was spreading across America soon after. The 509th received orders to man and train an atomic group, quote, capable of sustained independent action against any aggressor, which heralded the birth of the Cold War. The 509th, like Coca-Cola, has been reformulated more than once, but remains the same brand label. New Mexico would have already likely been an observation point of any out-of-our-world intelligences due to the presence of the scientific enclave established at Los Alamos to bring to fruition the secret mission of the Manhattan Project, that is, to construct America's first atomic bombs, which would later be dropped by this unit. And I think I'll leave it at that, so hopefully some people will still come to my lecture, Dean's lecture, actually. But he has done a remarkable amount of research. He has networked with serving and retired military personnel, with elected officials in the state of New Hampshire, a number of whom were witnesses to UFO phenomena, coupled with the area where the base was, at Pease Air Force Base, of course. So, yeah, I am looking forward to finishing the paper, for starters, and then to do my best job communicating Dean's research, wonderfully illustrated with a terrific PowerPoint presentation, to our audience in Roswell. And Dean has told me, much in the manner that James Clarkson moved forward to publication in a fairly timely way with his June Crane lecture, that before the end of this year, there will be a book out on this subject, and I'm so proud of him.
It sounds interesting. Gosh, I wish I could be there to hear it.
Well, you'll hear it after the fact. That's a guarantee. We have the good folks at Open Minds, who I understand will be recording our speakers digitally and professionally. And so there will be DVDs available at the lecture, and of course I will send you mine as soon as I get it for you guys to check out. But yeah, this is doubly interesting to me because it is so rare that, again, somebody is able to explore what just about all of us consider genuinely new research into such well-known incidents and cases and events that have already been the subject of, you know, dozens and dozens of books and hundreds of articles and, you know, more lectures and monographs than any of us are aware of. So, yeah, this is a bit of history in itself about our history. And for me, as you know, I'm a very pragmatic, very plodding, nuts and bolts researcher, and I don't get messages from Martians or, you know, none of the spirits of the universe channel their information to me. I'm stuck with very terrestrial and rather boring methodology of putting together the facts that constitute my work. So it's so nice to meet a brother in arms here who has done what I think will be a really world-class job on pulling this stuff together in a way that none of us have ever really seen. Very cool.
I kind of hope the guy comes up with a book about it.
Yeah, I think we can count on that. And
you'll have to let me know when he does.
Well, not only will I, but when he does, I'm just guessing that he may well want to appear on some radio shows. And, you know,
I'd be happy to have him on.
I think we can pull this together, yes. He's a total sweetheart, and again, I'm just so sorry that health considerations will not allow him to give this historic paper himself in Roswell, which is absolutely the correct place for it first to be aired, except, of course, for the beginning of the information, which was first aired on a show called Eye to the Sky.
Well, whether he gets a book out or not, I would still like to have him on.
I'd say it's a done deal. And
oh, you rock.
Yes, I think I can pull a string and wiggle a knob there and turn a lever and basically get you two together, and the rest is history.
Oh, because we've been, you know, highly interested in the Roswell case. I read Incident at Exeter a couple of times. I've read, I'm chuckling at David here. I've read Incident at Exeter a couple of times and have a copy of it. I've read Interrupted Journey two or three times and have a copy. You know, so I can go all he wants with this one. You know, and like I was saying just before we started the program tonight, that just to prepare myself, excuse me, tonight on this topic, I kind of broke out my copy of Jerome Clark's the UFO book, Encyclopedia of the Extraterrestrial. It's a great quick reference. And found that they had found a statement from a gentleman who in 1982 talked to Larry Fawcett and Barry Greenwood about an incident that happened to him the night of the incident at Exeter. In 1982, he was the chief of police in Hampton, New Hampshire. But on the night of the incident at Exeter, he was a sergeant in the Air Force, stationed at Pease Air Force Base with the 509th Security Police, standing gate guard or two other individuals, when an object came out of the sky and flew right over Pease Air Force Base, turning lights on, off as it went over and back on as it passed.
I would venture to say that there are many unknowns that have flown over Pease Air Force Base. And Pease is sometimes referred to, and Dean makes a point of it, as part of the New Hampshire Atomic Triangle. You have Pease Air Force Base, certainly atomic with the 509th. You have the I forget the name, but it's an important and well-known naval shipyard where the first nuclear submarines were launched from, as well as a nuclear power plant, and they are all within 20 miles of each other. And they have, I think, been responsible for attracting a huge amount of UFO activity. So I'm going to make an educated guess that Dean may well have included this account in his paper, but I don't know, and if he didn't, I will certainly bring it to his attention. But I know that he has a number of, I mean, just one parallel after the other. He's been kind of giving me bits and pieces of information in our conversations in person and over the phone for about a year now, and I am just hanging on his words, because I wasn't aware of these parallels. We all, you know, can only cover so much information, and many of us tend to specialize in certain areas of research, and there may be something just outside of our purview that we miss because it's not been brought to our attention. And again, just to reiterate, here is somebody who has pulled this together, and no one before him has to this degree. I'm delighted, actually, to learn that it looks very good that John Fuller, who, of course, was the very fine author of Incident at Exeter, far and away the best book on the 1965 New Hampshire UFO incidents, he's been gone for some years now, But I believe his widow will be joining us at the Exeter UFO conference, and it will be a bit of a festival too. It will be a one-day event, and that will take place on Saturday, September 4th. It will be the second one, and we're hoping it will be an annual conference as well. And Stan Friedman and I will be speaking this year, a number of wonderful local scholars, and possibly one or two other big names that, because they're not absolutely confirmed right now, I would rather not mention, but I know it'll be a wonderful event. And for anybody, especially in the Northeast, and of course more specifically in New England, Exeter, New Hampshire is not that far from you, and for anybody that has always wanted to visit New England at a perfectly beautiful time of year and see the epitome of a postcard picture perfect Currier and Ives town, Exeter, New Hampshire is emblematic of it, and I just had a wonderful time there last year.
I have a quick question for you. Norman Muscolero, he was the 18-year-old kid that first reported this to the police department.
Right.
Is he still alive?
I think so. I know that if he is, that Dean knows him and has spent time speaking with him. I think he is still with us. If I missed the fact of his passing, I know that, again, Dean did interview him and spent time with him, but I think that he is still around, and it would be wonderful if he can attend as well. Norman, if you're out there, please join us. But I will speak to Dean about that. And again, we're talking the first week in September. So if your schedule allows, maybe toward the end of August, I can come back on the show and give you all the details of the Exeter Conference as we then know them to be.
You know, I have to say that the two police officers that was out there in the field when, I'm trying to think of the names here. There was two officers, Eugene Bertrand. He was the one that drove back out to the field with Muscolero and was later joined by David Hunt. If I remember correctly, David Hunt was former Air Force and, you know, was very familiar with aircraft, and Blue Book come up saying, oh, it was the R-47 aircraft that were doing some maneuvers, you know, off that direction that night, but they were all done and over with by the time Muscolero had his sighting. The letter that these two men wrote to Hector Quintanilla of Blue Book, boy, those guys needed a good pat on the back for that letter.
Yeah. I think we see, when you really study the history of ufology, 1947 on, if you focus in enough beyond the sensation and the sweep and the implications of the incident, you find many regular human people, not that different than you or I or people who are listening to this show, regular people living their lives who are caught up in this story, and a good number of whom rise to the occasion and become world-class citizens in having the courage and the tenacity to come forward and put their knowledge on record. I think for me that's the most moving part of this area of study, the human aspect. We will never know fully what we're dealing with here, and I think anybody that feels otherwise is naive. But we can learn a great deal about the people who have helped us to put together the knowledge that we have so far. And that is something we can all relate to.
Oh, we have a question here from one of our virtual auditorium followers.
Mm-hmm.
This one is from New York, Lily, and she asks, How does Peter feel about, pursuant to Rule 123 of the Rules of Procedure on the Declassification of Documentation on UFOs, presented by Mario, I hope I don't mangle this last name up, Borghesio, to the European Parliament.
I was going to say, yes, member of the European Parliament. I've only become aware of this in the last week or so, and it seems quite legitimate to me, New York Lily, and okay, New York. I don't know. The first reports of it, I am not a big fan of the scholarship of Alfred Weber, and he is the author of this article, and I disagree with him on a great deal of stuff. However, this seems to be a fairly straight news report of a member of the European Parliament who takes the subject of the UFO cover-up seriously, and like many of us, would like to see information declassified and disseminated and made available to regular people in Europe and by implication to everyone else in the world. So this is a story I will be keeping a close watch on. History tends to repeat itself, and in ufology, in government takes on the subject, usually not very well. In this country, of course, our Senate and Congress have shown extraordinary lack of backbone in taking this on. I think we can understand why to a degree, but it does not excuse their lack of curiosity, courage, and grasping the implications of this subject. I witnessed it in my very early career in this field in a series of meetings of the Special Political Committee of the General Assembly in 1978, when the tiny little Caribbean country of Grenada, or Grenada, however you pronounce it, put forward a motion to make the subject of UFOs one for permanent United Nations study, research, and dissemination. The motion ultimately was carried, but then it was allowed to die quietly in committee over the next months, and it is still a dead issue, at least in the public area of United Nations activities. So I say bravo to this European Parliament representative, and we'll see if the European Parliament exercises any more curiosity and courage than their American counterparts have in the past. But very good question, and thank you for that, Lily.
Oh, Lily, she comes up with some good ones. she keeps her self up to date on current news and events in the world of ufology. She's a great gal. Got another one here. Oh, yes, this is a very good question. I don't think I can answer it, but maybe you can.
Mm-hmm.
This is from Loonster, and he asks, did anybody on the in the 509th see UFOs? Who on that crew, if they did, what did they see?
On which crew specifically?
Probably the cleanup crew, because it went there picking up the debris.
I would have to check some of the specialty research that's been done on that. We do know that a number of them saw artifacts. A few saw remains of the beings who were piloting these machines. Most recently, and I say this several degrees of separation away, but Walter Hout, who in modern ufology, folks who are familiar with Roswell, the city, may be aware, was one of the co-founders of the International UFO Museum and Research Center. But he was the base information officer at the time, and always maintained in his public statements, and certainly a man of worthy of respect and admiration, that he had never observed any actual things, but that he was absolutely convinced of their reality based on accounts confided to him by men who had. When he passed away several years ago in his early 90s, and I understand this, but I can't say, give you details on it, there was a codicil attached to his will that I understand said in so many words, "I love my country, I always took my national security oath seriously, and I would not have dreamt of violating it while I was alive. But now that I am not here, you should be aware that I did see remains and artifacts and debris. But I do not know. I would bet hard cash that, yes, many members of the 509th may well have seen UFOs, and probably out in New Hampshire as well, to put it mildly. The same way that most astronauts are loath to come forward and talk about sightings they may have had on different missions, but a few of them have, and we know through some of them, like Edgar Mitchell, who, by the way, went to high school in Roswell. Don't you love stuff like that?
Oh, yes.
Yeah.
And one other Apollo astronaut.
Yes, seventh man to walk on the moon. In fact, God, I sound like a name dropper, but I was in touch with him several times last week because the city of Roswell was hopeful that his schedule might allow for him to join us next month for the events. And he is not just a scholar, an American hero, a great mind, but Dr. Mitchell also is somebody who has had the courage to come forward and not just say, "I am speaking for people in the space program who I would trust with my life," in so many words, who have confided to me things that they were privy to in terms of what they saw or what they were aware of, but I have also been a witness to some of this phenomena. In any case, as I expected, he has a speaking engagement that weekend in England, so he won't be able to join us. But, there are people with the courage, and I'm sure there are people in the 509th that were in New Mexico and that were in New Hampshire. They're now at another base, I think, in the Midwest, and I forget where. Of course, I will learn as I continue to proof and follow this paper. We are dealing here with incidents that I'm as sure as I can be that were witnessed by members of that unit. It would seem logically impossible to me, bearing in mind the activity around Roswell back then and in New Hampshire in the 30 years that they were stationed there, that no member, we already know, you know, from your reading from Jerome Clark there, that's one member of the 509th who certainly saw a UFO, and you can bet dollars to donuts that when that thing went over the base and when others went over the Pease area, that they were also observed by serving officers and enlisted personnel. Wish I could be more specific, but thank you for that question.
You know, you mentioned the hot affidavit, David. I have problems with that.
Yep. And
I'm not problems with that.
Yeah, and I have never seen it. I have only heard about it. I'm trying to come from the spirit of innocent until proven guilty, which is our American system. But, there are questions surrounding it, and I am not a scholar in this area, but I do hope we learn more about it, and if it is authentic, that it is acknowledged as such. And if it's not, that we move on and continue our research and investigation.
Oh, my problem with it is he signed that in December of 2003. The following April of 2004, I was in Roswell, New Mexico. I went there because I figured, you know, the weather would be, you know, suitable for someone being on foot, because I went down via Greyhound.
Oh, cool.
And I, of course, the first place I went to was the museum. and I had the honor and privilege of meeting both Walter Hott and Glenn Dennis.
Cool.
I was allowed in their private office with the two of them and was able to talk with only Glenn Dennis. Beforehand, I was told that I was not allowed to ask Walter anything because his memory was so bad that he needed his daughter there to remind him of things.
Not a good sign.
So that's my reasoning behind having problems with that document.
Well, you know what? I would call that very good basic research and logical, deductive human reasoning. The fact is, of course, that dementia or forgetfulness in old age can be more gradual, or it can come upon you at an accelerated rate, depending on the aging process, whether there's an Alzheimer's factor or what have you. But I would take you seriously in making my basic evaluations and factor that in. That is troubling.
You know, like I said, I have difficulties with who wrote it, where did they get their information, how did they get their information? You know, that's the questions I have. You know, when was this thing originally written? Was he able to verify the facts in it? You know, that kind of thing. And, you know, it's easy for an individual to sign, okay, you know, here, Daddy, sign this. Okay, you know, sign it. You know, that kind of thing.
Yeah, that's a good question. I wish I knew the answer, but obviously it's something that deserves a great deal more attention. I agree.
Have you got any other things coming up besides Roswell, of course?
Yeah, I do, in fact. And right now, this past weekend, very unusual for me, I gave back-to-back talks this past Sunday in New York City for two decidedly different groups. Saturday last, I spoke for ARE, which is the Edgar Cayce Foundation. They have offices in New York, and the title of my talk was UFOs, Organized Religion, and Fundamentalist Thinking. And it was not very transcendent or filled with goodness and light, but I think the audience was engaged by it. And the very next day, I spoke to a group called Disclosure Network New York, which I don't think is an actual affiliate, so to say, of the Disclosure organization founded by Stephen Greer. But it was a very informal three-hour roundtable. The title of that lecture was Talking to Americans about UFOs. And I covered a number of subjects, including UFO ridicule in the media, religion and UFOs, talked a bit about Roswell, and about the dilemma that many people in the field feel when such a serious topic attaches itself to an overriding sponsor that calls itself a festival. And as a good friend and a person in the field better known than I, whose name I'm sure almost all of your listeners know, said to me some years back, I would never be involved in something that called itself a festival. The subject is just too serious. I know they can coexist. For me, the key is nothing mean-spirited, nothing vicious, nothing condescending. It makes sense in a way that sooner or later the pop culture aspects of this would express themselves in a festival, and the psychological aspects of the troubled psyche of human beings around the implications of this subject. And we all know, as they say, whistling in the dark, having a little fun at the expense of your anxiety is not an unhealthy thing. But as for upcoming talks, I'm going to be giving a talk at the Roswell Public Library on July 5th, which is a tradition of mine. I do it as a fundraiser for the library, and it will probably be a talk around why we need to take UFOs seriously. And the festival crowd will be gone, so it'll be mostly local folks, and I really adore that one. On April 11th, I'll be speaking for a UFO roundup group that Rich and Karen Dolan are involved in Rochester, and it's a very effective one. It works out of a local library there. I think it actually, they used the Barnes & Noble, a meeting room in Barnes & Noble in Rochester. And that will be Wednesday, August 11th for anyone in Western New York State. On September 4th, of course, I'll be speaking in Exeter, New Hampshire. On September 11th, I'm going to be doing a first for me, which is a live Skype lecture and then informal discussion and questions and answers for Michigan MUFON in Detroit and for Detroit or Flint, Michigan. I'll have to double check that. I'm sorry, I take that back. For Minnesota MUFON and Denver MUFON. And I'll be, they've asked me to represent my paper on UFOs, human nature, and politics, which I'm very proud of. And I think the following weekend, on Saturday, September 18th, I will be speaking for Michigan MUFON, and anybody in that area can Google them online and find out the particulars. The following month, I'll be speaking for Pennsylvania MUFON at a conference they're having in Pittsburgh, October 16th. And there, they've asked me to give a talk that I developed some years ago, but that nobody has ever asked me to give, that it's not an unserious talk, but it combines my background as an artist and a painting instructor and a graphic designer when I was younger and somebody who... actually has gold and platinum records for art direction for CBS when we had records back there. I'm proudly looking at them on my wall here. And it's a talk that I call The Graphics and the Classics, the Golden Age of UFO Literature. And it's going to be an exploration of the phenomenal amount of very creative and in some ways ludicrous, in other ways chillingly accurate, renditions of the subject, often things that ended up on the jackets of books and the covers of paperbacks in the 50s and into the early 60s, with the background going back to the 20s, 30s, and 40s as far as some of these lurid graphic traditions in science fiction that morphed in the later 40s to become the basis of early UFO-related illustrations. So I'm really looking forward to doing that one. It will be a real departure for me, but it's a way to share an aspect of the culture of UFO studies and representations. Again, many of them so far from accurate that they really do put a smile on your face. And in other cases, brilliant, powerful graphic designs that drew early readers to the cover of books that went on to become classics. Following that, I'm sorry to say, and your listeners should know if they were planning on going at this, the 8th Annual Crash Retrieval Conference, which is a staple in Las Vegas, Nevada, that many of us were looking forward to in November, Ryan Wood, the brilliant organizer and wonderful writer and researcher behind that, because of just business and family, is taking a year off, so we will not have that conference this year, which is a shame, and I will miss it, but I think we'll look forward to it all the more in 2011, the last year of civilization before the Earth explodes, which I will not be holding my breath for.
That's a shame, because that's one of the more well-organized...
Oof, it's brilliantly organized. And boy, does he pull together a great roster of people every year. For some people, especially folks that are not involved in this field like we are, the title may be lurid, and many of the talks are devoted to areas of crash and retrieval study. I'm very proud of the fact that I've spoken there, I guess, 5 out of 7 years, and I've never spoken on either, but... Bless Ryan, he likes my work, and you know, the talks are compelling. But that's my schedule as it stands thus far, so I'm available. You can email me at probinsny@yahoo.com should you be interested in looking into having me be a speaker for your organization, library, group, church, whatever?
We have, about 3 minutes to go.
What do you want to do with that 3 minutes?
Well, I'd like you to give the website address for the Roswell Festival.
Yes. It's one that sounds like we spun it around, but in fact it is UFOFestivalRoswell.com, and that will take you to a website that gives the entire schedule of the 4 days of events, the symposium, the film festival, all of the concerts, the entertainment aspects. I believe we also have a link to the museum's schedule, and the museum, of course, has its own program of speakers and presentations and their own series of lighter-hearted events. So there will be plenty to do, in fact, too much to do. We've tried very hard to not schedule events against each other, but it's almost inevitable that there will be conflicts, and if you come, you will have to make hard decisions.
And where people can go to listen to the roundtable Rendlesham discussion tomorrow night.
Yes, a very important question. And again, I hope that as many of your listeners as possible will tune in, because this is going to be live radio at its best. You can hear it online at either www.newskyradio.com or para, that's P-A-R-A, -X.com. And the two shows that are making themselves available for this historic three-hour live on rehearsed broadcast are Behind the Paranormal and CAPS Paranormal in different parts of our wonderful country.
Oh, yes, and David wants me to remember to say that I will be on In Focus Paranormal Talk Radio tonight on Block Talk Radio, and that David, I can find what I did with my piece of paper here, will be on Joe Montalvo's program this coming Wednesday.
And please try not to miss either of those shows. And as far as hearing Dee as a guest rather than a host, just don't even turn off your radio. Leave it on, and she'll be on in a while.
In 2 hours. I get a two-hour break with it to get the headset out of my ear for a while. Hey, Peter, as always, it's been great. I enjoyed every minute of it.
Me too, dear.
We did already, Billy. David's over here telling me, give the Roswell.
Oh, we got it, Dave. Thanks.
Extra
responsible. I'm sorry that you and your remarkable producer husband will not be joining us in Roswell this year, but we'll hope for the best next year. I will have a report for you, and I'll make sure that you get to see Dean's talk.
Oh, that would be wonderful. I would thoroughly enjoy that.
No problem.
And unfortunately, we are all out of time. 2 hours is never enough.
Nope.
Thanks again for joining us, Peter. It's been great.
You're welcome, Dee.
And unfortunately, that's all the time we have for tonight. I'd like to thank everyone for tuning in, and also thank those who joined us here in the Powell Talk Auditorium. Stay tuned for Voice of the People, hosted by November Hansen. Her guest tonight will be Jim Elvidge. Please join us again next Saturday for Eye to the Sky, the UFO Synopsis. Until then, keep an eye to the sky. Good night, everyone.